good common sense conclusion that the high gain antenna with a sharp beam has to be carefully aimed on its way using a rotator. Absolutely not true. The so-called high gain antenna is going to have a 50 degree wide beam width. You're going to be scooting the antenna back and forth 2 and 3 degrees at a time, because that antenna on most of those television channels, the real antenna pattern, the manufacturer is going to give you a couple of pretty looking antenna pictures, antenna pattern pictures. Maybe on channel 37 it gives a good pattern, but on channel 39 it gives you an ugly pattern with lobes all over the place. And channel 39 is the one you want to watch, so to speak. So therefore, when co-channel interference comes in from Pennsylvania at an angle that's 20 degrees different than the World Trade Center from your location, and by you scooting the antenna a couple of degrees back and forth, you can make that co-channel interference channel fall into one of those notches. The antenna pattern on your particular favorite channel. Let me drop. It's a very complicated pattern. It's got peaks and lobes all over the place. And when you're getting co-channel interference, and your digital television demodulator cannot tolerate another signal coming in that's not, let me pick a number, 20 decibels weaker. If it's only 10 dB weaker, the bit error rate of your demodulator will go sky high, and it will tell you across the screen, weak signal. Boom. It thinks that a high error rate is a weak signal. It's really getting two separate signals simultaneously, and it can't tolerate it. By you scooting the antenna back and forth in azimuth a couple of degrees, you will take that co-channel and steer it into one of those nulls of that complicated antenna pattern, while the peak of the signal is still essentially on Empire State Building, and all of a sudden you'll start receiving that channel. So digital television has got that crazy characteristic. It can't tolerate a second signal that's not a large number of dB weaker. Over to you, George, for any fill on that. KD2FIU, K2IW.
Very good, Dick. I like that. K2RIW, KD2FIU. It's kind of like a shift in the shift. Even though you're narrowing the bandwidth, you're getting a better part of the signal by shifting in slightly off of what you want to eliminate the interference from the higher part of the bandwidth or the lower part of the bandwidth. Is that correct?
That's correct. And when you say the word bandwidth, you mean frequency bandwidth and not antenna pattern bandwidth or beamwidth, so to speak. The beamwidth of the main lobe is so darn broad that if there was only one channel there, you would never have to re-aim the antenna when you're watching World Trade Center. But the reflection you get off of the building, the co-channel interference, even the reflection you get off of the building comes in at some crazy angle. And you want to steer the antenna pattern so that crazy angle falls into one of the notches of the antenna pattern. 30 degrees off to one side, you get a deep notch. And the reflection you get off that water tower is giving you a kind of interference that your digital demodulator cannot tolerate. It can't tolerate the time difference between the main signal and the bounce signal. And if you can take the angle of arrival of the bounce signal and steer it into one of the nulls of the pattern, all of a sudden you'll get beautiful reception. So digital television, over-the-air reception, in my opinion, requires a rotator. A bunch of people don't believe it. Each person who's put on a rotator said, wow, what an improvement. All the times that I used to get dropout of those channels, I don't get dropouts anymore. If I'm willing to do a little bit of a steering on Tuesday, a little bit of different steering than I did on Thursday, if you know what I mean. And with any further questions on this, give me a call letters right now. K2IW and TechNet.
I'll argue with you.
Go ahead, Eric.
First of all, where George is located, he doesn't need a rotor. I'm sorry, I disagree with that so much. I've got, actually, the Metropolitan TV Association has a number of receive sites where the antennas are close in. Some of them are less than 20 foot off the ground. They don't have rotors on them. And they're fixed. And they work fine. And actually, when here I start seeing the Philadelphia station banging into Beijing in the city, they don't see it at all. And that's at multiple different locations on multiple different antennas that are aimed by a human being, put up once locked down. Now, I do have to comment about preamps, okay? I can show you a lot of situations where people put in an amplifier, and the only reason why you would ever really want to use the amplifier is to overcome cable loss. Noise figures of some of these amplifiers, they look like they're decent, you know, 3 dB, 4 dB is enough to wreck the signal, so to speak. So you'll find in a lot of applications where people put antenna preamps up, you know, it actually makes it worse than if they don't have a preamp. If you're doing DX things, sometimes you can put the antenna in to get you enough signal, the amplifier in to get you enough signal to lock up, and sometimes you have to take the amplifier out to get enough signal, because not only is it a broadband amplifier, it picks up all of the natural noises that are around, and that disturbs things. You get a certain amount of intermodulation, and so on and so forth. So if you're really going to use a preamp, you just want it to have enough amplifier to overcome the loss of the cable going to the TV set. That's my comment. Q2RIW, K2EK.
In a second, I'm going to go over to Joe for comments and all this. Let me hit the beat. Joe, there are two subjects there where you've got personal experience, with and without preamp. You've got personal experience about a good high antenna that you're moving in azimuth in order to stop the co-channel interference or the multi-bounce that is making your digital demodulator go bonkers. So I think you are probably in favor of a rotator, no matter where the person is located, other than a mile away from the broadcast center. And you probably have some opinions on preamp. So B2RYY, K2RIW, you've got to show way to the beat. Somebody was super weak, and after Joe, I'm going to have to try to pick you up again. Joe first, away for the beeps, you got a Joe.
Okay, yeah, I use a preamp on the system. I understand about all the noise things that you're talking about, Eric. They can overload the preamp and so forth, and out-of-band signals, but I also have a filter on the thing, so nearby cell sites, 800 megahertz or even 700 megahertz, start getting rolled off dramatically. Because I realize the preamp and the antenna have a response up to 890 megahertz, and I don't want to have all that energy coming into the preamp, so I have a filter, a low-pass filter, that stops anything above 700 megahertz. And when the TV channels change, I'll have to buy another one to stop stuff probably about 600 megahertz or so. So I do understand all about that. You know, it's everybody's choice. You can put it up an antenna with no preamp, and you're living 50 miles away, and then you might find out with the line loss and running it through a coupler downstairs to feed multiple television sets, you end up getting a certain amount of loss across those devices. So I decided ahead of time to buy a preamp, one that takes a lot of signal to overload to begin with, has a high overload factor, and it gives me a reasonable amount of gain to overcome my line loss and my splitter loss going to each particular TV set location. Over to you, Dick.
Good information. Tell us also about your use of a rotator during multipath or co-channel interference. Major with each, you got a show.
Oh yeah, I do exactly what you said, Dick, because understanding where the other channel probably is coming from, on many channels I do know where the strongest co-channel possibility probably is going to be coming from, and when the band opens up during the spring, early spring, mid-spring, and into late fall, and you get these coastal band openings up and down the coast, you can get stuff from Hartford, Connecticut, just booming in, and that kills it. So I do exactly what you said. I steer the antenna a couple of degrees one way or the other way to put the WFSB from Hartford into a null, and that helps with channel two. Not all the time, but it helps quite a bit. It also works on all the channels too, so that's a very good thing. And I do understand that the polar pattern of each particular antenna is probably on their favorite frequency, or the best polar plot they're going to give you, and I may not represent what the polar plot is exactly on every single channel of the advertising antenna that you're to cover for the bands. But the antenna I have covers, channel 2. Covers channel 2 to 6, 7 to 13, and 14 to 69. That's the rating of the antenna, the way it's made by Sonic, I think, right now. or even 8. Now, 69 I rate this one, too. And it's, 169 inches boom length. I don't recall how many elements that the antenna has, but it's a lot more than 13. But I'm going with gain. And the reason I go for gain and so forth is because on the worst, crappiest day, rain, snow, whatever, the only weather condition that does not, the antenna really can't overcome is sometimes you get periods of fog, certain types of fog conditions, and we'll lose some TV channels out of New York. The ones that have the weakest signal to begin with, they're the first ones to go. But generally, 99% of the time, in other conditions, rain, snow, things like that, I don't lose a signal out of New York.
Repeater, timeout.
Yeah, I heard it. Except for an airplane passing across the path of the television signal. That, I don't think any antenna is going to be able to deal with something like that, be able to get rid of it.
Very fine, Joe. Good information. So let's see, Rich, if you need fill on any of the above. N2EO, K2RAW. You've got it there, Rich. Wait for the beep. And maybe Rich got called away. The next person on our list was George, 82FIU. Go right ahead, George.
Thank you, Dick. 82FIU. And you know what? I'll pass this along for another session. I'll check in for another session with the topic. And it had to do with interference on the ground of HF verticals, very tall HF verticals, ground-mounted, and weather conditions and soil conditions. I'll pass it along because we're in a little bit higher frequency mode tonight, and I'm doing that to let the next moderator bring his show in.
Okay, IS query, I think that's Bill, wait a minute, IS query, you had a weak signal, so speak slowly.
This is AC2IS with a query that, yes, this is Bill, and I'm control for Daniel right now.
Okay, your signal is 50% audio, 50% noise, so speak distinctly, a little bit louder if you can, Bill, and go right ahead with your query.
Okay, here's Daniel.
Is space unlimited?
It has to be, Daniel, because if it was limited, if you could go out there and say, hey, space ends right here because there's a great big wall, it would be just a matter of time before somebody would drill a hole in that wall and find out what's outside of it. So space has to go on for infinity. In my opinion, there's no choice. There's a hell of a lot more to the answer to that, but as you can see, there can't be an end. Because what would that end look like? You would drill a hole in that end and find out what's beyond it. You've got it, Daniel. AC2IS, wait for the beep. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Can it be a wraparound universe?
I've heard that theory a whole lot of times, and it's great sounding science fiction. The chance of that being real, where you send a rocket in one particular direction, and if the rocket's got enough range, it's going to hit you in the back of the head, not a chance. In my opinion, not a chance. We've already seen, by way of radio telescopes and optical telescopes and so on, we've seen objects 14 billion miles away, 14 billion light years away. 14 billion, in other words, at the speed of light, it took 14 billion years for that signal to get here. And it got here by way of a straight line. So if you don't see a wraparound in 14 billion years, 14 billion light years, can there really be a wraparound? As I said, great sounding science fiction, there appears to be no evidence that it exists. Back to you, Daniel.
This is Bill, AC2IS. I think that's it for us. Thank you.
Okay. Sounds like a new ham or a new science operator is on the way. Is that true, Bill?
Well, we have some aspirations. We'll see. AC2IS.
Sounds like you're being an Elmer or a mentor. Good luck. Okay, Charlie was the next guy I know. It's KD2, Jill O, November Hotel. You've got it, Charlie. K2RIW and TechNet. We'll wait for the beeps, Charlie.
Oh, good evening, Dick. My question was concerning a magnetic loop antenna. From what I've seen, it looks like the center conductor and the coax shielding both go to either side of the smaller loop. And can you explain to me why that's not a bad idea?
Okay, the word loop antenna is a whole class of antennas, Charlie. One particular embodiment is the loop is made out of some large diameter copper tubing, we'll say. It's got one turn to it. And at one end, there is an air variable capacitor, which resonates that loop. Then you feed your signal from your coax cable into that by way of a small loop somewhere near the big loop. The small loop is like the primary of a transformer, and the secondary is a real resonator. But when you do it that way, you've got a beautiful floating system where you don't have to worry about where the shield of the coax goes. That little loop, ordinarily that little loop would have very low gain, but because it is magnetically coupled to the big resonating loop, and by way of adjusting the distance, the location, and the diameters, you can make a perfect match at least at one frequency. Therefore, a loop antenna with that particular embodiment works like a charm. There are other kinds of loop antennas where the resonator at a low frequency has multiple turns to it. If you wanted to build a loop antenna, let me drop a quick. If you wanted to build a loop antenna for the 300 kilohertz band with multiple turns to the loop and some method of feeding it, there's lots of different ways of feeding it, that can be an extremely high performance antenna, even though it is a hundredth of a wavelength in diameter, and you would think it's going to work terrible. It could have extremely good performance. So the word loop antenna, there's a whole, I was going to use some profanity. There's a whole group of antennas that are called loop antennas, and there's lots of different ways of building them, lots of different ways of feeding them. So do a little bit of research on your particular loop antenna for your particular frequency. Loop antennas can be used on UHF frequencies, like you could build a loop antenna for 2 gigahertz if you wanted to, which would work like a charm, or you could build it for 200 kilohertz if you wanted to, which is a million times lower in frequency, so to speak. And the theory of operation, even though they look very different, the theory of operation can be the same. Let me drop one more time. And your AM transistorized radio works on a ferrite loop antenna, where you've got a ferrite rod in the middle of the multiple turn loop, which does a beautiful job of resonating. It picks up the magnetic field as opposed to the E field. Works like a charm, can have extremely good performance, even though, again, it's a hundredth or a thousandth of the wavelength in length. So, as you can tell, there's lots of kinds of loop antennas. Over to you, Charlie. KD2 KNH, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. That's exactly what I was talking about. The magnetic loop with the larger loop, the 1 to 5 ratio. But it's just always, in my mindset, for my whole entire life, it's almost like shorting out your radio antenna to the direct to the coax, like it would be some bad effect. But I'm assuming it's just a basic oscillating circuit, basically.
In the case of that UHF loop antenna that you're describing, where there's a small loop that seems to match to it, and it looks like a short circuit on the end of the coax cable, if you took that coax cable in that short loop and physically took it away from the big resonating loop, and now you measure the impedance, yes, you would see something extremely close to a short circuit on your coax cable. You connect your vector network analyzer or your antenna tuner to that transmission line, and you'll think you're seeing a short circuit. That so-called short circuit, when it's brought into the near field resonance range of the big resonating loop, all of a sudden that can be a 50 ohm impedance at your favorite frequency. I'm going to try to give you another example of that, which I had in my mind, and all of a sudden it went out of my mind. So the District of Residence. Oh yeah, here's another example. Let me drop a click. Let's assume now that I've got a 60-cycle transformer, a 1-to-1 transformer, an isolating transformer. I put 120 volts into the primary. I get 120 volts out of the secondary. I put normal loads on that secondary. I measure what load I see on the primary. Everything's hunky-dory. I put no load on the secondary. The primary, if I made a careful impedance measurement, I would see a little bit of inductive reactance, if you know what I mean. Essentially, I would see an open circuit. Take that primary winding. Open up the transformer and remove the EI lamination so that the iron is now gone. And you measure that primary winding at 60 cycles with good instrumentation. You will see a short circuit. That primary winding only has a large enough inductance. It represents an open circuit only when the inductance is there, when the magnetic circuit is there that couples the primary to the secondary. There's a little bit of commonality of that circuit versus what happens with the UHF loop. So many a input circuit looks like a short circuit until you put it into the real world of the magnetic field of that transformer or the resonating near field of that great big loop of that UHF antenna. It becomes an entirely different object. It's hard to believe that something that starts off as a short circuit can become an open circuit when you put it at the right distance from that great big resonating loop. Of course that's crazy. Mother Nature does it that way. Take my word for it, Charlie. KD2 KNH. You can do a bunch of experiments to confirm that. K2LIW in the Tech Man.
All right, Dick. Thank you very much. You've cleared up my mental block, and I've got a better idea of understanding how it works. But thank you very much.
Yeah, Mel, K2KEY, who's now a silent key, was building loop antennas, operating him from the basement of his house in Manhattan Beach, Brooklyn. And boy, was he getting extremely good reception on frequencies like 300 KC, 3 megacycles, 30 megacycles, different antennas. But a loop antenna inside the house can give you essentially the same performance as a 80-meter antenna, say, for instance, that's 132 foot long as a dipole. It's hard to believe that this loop that's only a few feet in diameter can give the exact same performance. And so when you couple to the outside world, magnetically by way of a loop, as opposed to, let me call it electrostatically, by way of a dipole, it's hard to believe to pick up the same amount of signal with the same efficiency. And because the loop antenna is so much smaller, people are afraid to use it as a transmitter. If you build it out of the right materials, you can transmit into that antenna that's a tenth or a hundredth of a wavelength in diameter. And it works. That loop antenna in your transistorized radio, you'd be amazed how high the efficiency and the performance of that thing is, even though it's a thousandth of the wavelength of the signal you're picking up. Just a matter of using the right technique, if you know what I mean. Ed's the next guy on our list. KD2, Charlie Tango Yankee. You've got it, Ed. K2LIW in the Tech Net.
KD2, CQY. And I just have a quick question about EMF when you're using a magnetic antenna in the car. I heard you say one time that the EMF range of a antenna was 3 feet. So what is the effect when operators in the car on EMF and help risks and that sort of thing? KD2, CQY.
Yeah, what you're calling EMF, Ed, the vocabulary that's accepted will be a little bit more understanding if you call it radio frequency biohazard, electromagnetic field. Those three words are used in a lot of circumstances. You're talking about radio frequency biohazard. And now what you're asking has an extremely different answer depending on whether you're using on the automobile, a mag mount at 450 on the top of the car, a screwdriver antenna on 80 meters mounted to the bumper of the car, so you get very different answers depending on what frequency, what kind of antenna, how much power, and so on. And is there some fixed distance like 5 feet for every one of these circumstances? Of course not. Let me drop. So, if I was talking about putting out 100 watts on 450 megacycles into a mag mount, mounted to the roof of the automobile, and it's a metal roof antenna, that can be fairly safe with you inside the car. The car is acting like a pretty good Faraday shield, and very little of the RF energy is getting to you, assuming that the rest of your transmission line and your rig is pretty well shielded. When in doubt, make measurements. When you're operating that screwdriver antenna mounted to the bumper of the car, you're putting a kilowatt into it at 3.5 megahertz. There, the amount of RF that gets to you is a bit stronger, but the good news, 3.5 megacycles, the body has very little response. When it comes to radio frequency biohazard, let me drop. The defining document for the United States is the C95 report. The American National Standards Institute, the division of the IEEE, for the last 30 years, has this document, which is the defining document for the United States. It's used by NIOSH, OSHA, Department of Defense, whatever. It defines how many milliwatts per square centimeter, how much RF energy you can pump into a human being, at what frequency, where is the threshold of alarm, if you know what I mean. When you look at that curve of how much power you can put into a human being versus frequency, it's a bathtub-shaped curve. Between 30 and 300 megacycles of the RF energy that hits you, most of it gets absorbed and turned into heat, and that's the so-called dangerous region. At lower frequencies than 30 megacycles, an awful lot of the energy passes through you with no absorption and has no effect. Above 1500 megacycles, 20% of the energy is absorbed and 80% reflects off the surface of your skin. So, pound for pound, of 1500 megacycles, the microwave region is 5 to 1 safer than the VHF region between 30 and 300 megacycles. Let me drop. That information is the so-called C95 report, which, by the way, has got a title that goes on for a paragraph. American National Standards Institute, C95 report. It gets updated every couple of years. I think it's in Rev F or Rev G by now. And so it's got this curve of how much energy you're allowed to put into a human being versus frequency. All of the last 30 and 40 years of testing by all of the world's best laboratories and institutions in the United States, and there's a similar document for the United Kingdom, and there's another one for Japan, and so on. They all hang together. They have discovered that RF energy, when it hits a human being, gets converted to heat. That's the only effect they have been able to confirm, the so-called thermal effect. For 30 years, they've been looking for the non-thermal effect. They'd like to think that some of the energy gets directly connected into your nerves and creates phony signals. Good theory, they can't confirm it. It probably doesn't exist. So whether or not, and the amount of heating, the most vulnerable part, let me drop. The most vulnerable part of a human being is your eye. Your eye cannot tolerate heating, otherwise you might get a cataract from it. So as long as you keep it below, let me pick a number, 10 milliwatts or 1 milliwatt per square centimeter, which represents a certain distance at a certain frequency from a certain amount of power going into a certain antenna. As you can see, there's a lot of variables here. 99% of all the things human beings that ham radio operators do happens to be safe. Because you call it RF radiation, everybody develops this fear, particularly microwave radiation. They've got xenophobia for the word. When it comes to RF radiation, they think it's as dangerous as nuclear radiation. They have nothing to do with each other. If the engineers back in 1900 had decided to call it RF transmitting and RF signaling, they wouldn't have this problem. They called it RF radiation. The signal coming out of an antenna goes in all directions. It radiates. Perfectly good word then. World War II came along. Now we have nuclear radiation and everybody's scared. Nuclear radiation consists of subatomic particles moving at close to the speed of light. They're microscopic bullets that penetrate your skin, and they do damage. RF energy is not bullets. It's a signal. It's a wave. The wave creates heat. You drop the thing. You put your food in the microwave oven. You give it an amount of RF energy that's a million times greater than you're ever going to get from a radio signal you stand near an antenna on your ham radio. The microwave oven is cooking your food, the RF energy is being absorbed, turned into heat. It's a million times greater. And we don't worry about creating cancer in the foods that we eat in the microwave oven. As you can see, RF energy itself does not create cancer. As long as you keep the amount of exposure below the point where heating of the eye would take place, you're not going to suffer. And that document, difficult to read, it's very technical, probably got about 150 pages to it, some fancy diagrams, but take my word for it, most of the thing ham radio operators do is pretty safe. But when in doubt, there's ways you can make a measurement of how much RF energy you're getting inside your automobile. What you've asked is a complicated question, lots of different frequencies, lots of different conditions, lots of different antennas, lots of different powers. Boil it down to what's the example, what's the situation you would like to try, Ed? So I think I can make most of your fear disappear. CD2CTY, K2LIW, go ahead, Ed.
I'm just talking about magnetic mount to be over my head. It'll be like UHF, VHF, that kind of thing.
Yep. If you put 50 watts into a mag mount on the top of the roof of your car, you'd be amazed how safe that is. Your biggest amount of radiation inside the car will be the small amount of leakage from the case of your transmitter or from the leakage from the coax cable if you didn't do a good job of installing the connector on the end. The car itself is an extremely good shield in that case, as long as it's really a metal roof. If it's a plastic roof like a fiberglass that's made out of a Corvette, that
repeater, timeout.
If it's a fiberglass roof of a Corvette, very different situation. You'd have to use a different kind of balanced antenna to make sure that you're not launching a signal into the body of the car. But 50 watts into a 2 meter or 450 or 1296 mag mount. Lots of guys have done that. I'm one of them. I had in my hand a radiation hazard meter made by the Narda company. And while transmitting 50 watts into that antenna, I tried to make a measurement inside the car on how much RF energy was getting there. It was below the bottom scale of the radiation hazard meter. I couldn't even make it register. So I was at least 20 dB safe, if you know what I mean. So if you take the mag mount off the roof of the car and throw it into the back seat because you're going to park somewhere and you don't want to advertise as a ham radio operator, and then you start driving and forget where the mag mount antenna is, and you start transmitting with the mag mount antenna inside the car with you. A number of hams have done that. That sounds like a very, very dangerous situation. As bad as that one sounds, when you make a measurement, you'd be amazed how safe that is, partially because the antenna is not as resonant now, and not as much of the antenna's signal is really being radiated. So guys have done that, and they haven't suffered from it. Back to you, Ed. KD2CTY, make sure you wait for the beep. K2RSW, you got it in.
And this is KD2CTY. Yeah, I think you answered my question. I was a little worried about that, but it seems like I have nothing to worry about. KD2CTY, thank you.
And one last thing, when it comes to the amount of RF energy, radio frequency biohazard, that creates danger to a human being, the thermal energy that gets into your eye is the thing you got to worry about. The eye has a 6 minute thermal time constant. Just like when you're heating a pot of water on the stove, you can't heat it instantaneously. The amount of heat you give to the material in your eye takes 6 minutes to do it. If you do a key down transmitter for 6 minutes, that's one condition. If you only run key down for 30 seconds, you could run 10 times more power and be safe. Because you integrate over 6 minutes to calculate the amount of heating that potentially can do some damage to a human being. You can see by way of the timing, by way of the distance, by way of the energy, by way of the absorption. There's a whole lot of things in your favor. You have to do a bunch of dumb things in a row, so to speak, to get yourself in trouble with the situation that you're describing. Okay, I think we've put down a list of everybody who signed in. And timely, let me make sure that I haven't forgotten somebody. Give me a call at KQIW.net. Okay, it's time we go over to the science and space, the science and physics report by Dr. Roy, EC2GS. And he's got his problem, he's got some darn many subjects he could be discussing. Choosing the one that's your favorite tonight could be a little bit difficult. And once again, we're operating without the Eastern machine on Selden. That machine is not connected tonight. Our internet is not connected tonight. And Eric EC2EJ, our technical maven of this repeater, is going to, he's working on trying to fix a fairly difficult problem. So, Roy, EC2GS, K2RIW, you got a sensor, Roy.
Hello, Dick. Hello, everyone. It's AC2GS. And once again, if you have any questions of science and physics, send them to me. The email address is mailbag@limartech.net. Again, mailbag@limartech.net. And we could do anything that you want. I could answer questions if there are people who have questions. I could give you another grab bag like last week. Or we can run on the topic of magic with magnets. But before we get to that, let me just take up the subject of RF exposure. Let me drop first. Now, there was yet another report that was released by the FDA about RF safety, and according to the latest lab experiment, and I don't know how people get paid for things like this, they exposed rats for 2 years for 7 hours a day with 2G and 3G cell phone frequencies and found that the male rats developed tumors on their heart. So as long as you're not a male rat and you don't spend 7 hours a day next to an antenna that's operating, you're pretty much safe. But the funny thing is that the ARRL sent out a newsletter about a guy that is going to be testing what appears to be a shower cap with electrodes on it with small 900 megahertz antennas. And his theory is that low-level 900 megahertz RF actually improves people's problems with Alzheimer's. I thought that that was going to end with the newsletter, but apparently they rushed out a QST article, and so you guys who own QST, who subscribe to it, the March issue, and I think they made particularly sure that it didn't show up in the April issue, because a lot of people would probably think it was a bit of April Fool's. There's actually an article in the March QST on this guy's experiment, and I wish him luck, but I'm very, very dubious. So that's my little short take on RF exposure. Now, if any of you guys have any questions, feel free to ask. Otherwise, I'll come up with a subject on my own.
Let me go back to that. What a number of years of exposure for cell phone signals at 2 and 3 gigahertz to these rats who developed an increase in cardiac problems. What's your guess? Is there any way of knowing approximately how strong was the signal? Was this a cell phone running at the 1 watt level and it's only 6 inches away from the rat? The cell phone is running 24 hours a day. I mean, there's a huge number of variables here. What frequency, what power, what distance, how many hours, what was the on time and off time, and so on. And would a person really run a cell phone that way? Get any of those details, Roy, AC2GS, K2RIW?
Yeah, I was trying to hunt down all the details, but for some odd reason, the paper that they released is very, very light on them. They describe the frequencies as two generation and third generation cell phone frequencies, and they describe as opposed to 4G and 5G network frequencies, and they describe the time as every day for approximately 7 hours a day, but for 2 years. But they don't really go into detail of how much the power of people and how far they were away from an antenna, one would assume that it's a lot more than a cell phone level, but they don't quite make any mention of the actual power output or the type of antenna or the distance.
Yeah, let me show you a problem with that. Let me drop. One of the things that was discovered somewhat by the Academy of Model Aeronautics, AMA, for operators of radio-controlled model airplanes. A human being standing up with a radio transmitter in his hand and a whip antenna coming out of the top of it, running at roughly 75 megacycles, they discovered a human being standing up, his body has its first resonance of around 75 megacycles. So the guy holding onto that radio-controlled transmitter 20 years ago, he thought all the signal going to his airplane was coming off that whip antenna. A significant amount of it was coupled to his body, which was resonant and re-radiating the signal. This rat in this laboratory is a much smaller animal. For all we know, the length of his body resonates at roughly 2 gigs. And if 2 gigs was one of the signals being used by the cell phone, you could be getting a response to that rat because of the rat's body resonance that would be very different from a human being. So even if they did see this deleterious effect, it doesn't necessarily mean it relates to a human being. AC2GS, K2LAW, in the tech man.
AC2GS, I would agree with you entirely, Dick, and so did the FDA. The FDA's conclusion was that, quote, they are still confident that the current limits on cell phone radiation are safe. So, you know, what can I tell you? They haven't disproven that there's the safety of the thing, but they'll keep on giving guys money to run tests. But I'm fascinated in a weird way by the guy who's going to try and cure Alcon.
Yeah, that sounds like a great sounding theory, but there's no way in the world you can do a double blind test to really confirm. I mean, a certain percent of the population is going to get Alzheimer's, and now you and I can be questioning whether or not this is genetic, whether or not this is environmental, whether or not it's a particular guy's diet, the way he lives, the amount of sleeping he gets, the ladies he's dated. There's all kinds of variables involved as to who is going to get Alzheimer's and what are you going to be using as your theory of the causative effect and whether or not you can make an improvement by doing some kind of a change. Very complicated issue. To try to confirm this theory, even if it's accurate, it's going to be very difficult as I see it. Probably somewhat how you see it, the Roy, K2LAW.
Yes, it's a very difficult thing to prove. And you know, I mean, if you take a look at the pictures that they're published in the state, they look sort of silly. I mean, really, if they had published this a month later, I would have sworn that this was an April 1st thing, because USC used to do that a lot.
Roughly how long ago did you get your launch issue? I am a life member of QST. I normally get my issue about the 13th or 14th day of the month. I haven't received my March issue yet. So, how long have you had yours? And I hope mine is in the mail to me. And maybe I'm going to find out that my mailman was reading that article about this funny looking skill cap. Over to you, Roy.
Actually, I haven't gotten mine either, but I cheat. The electronic publication about 10 days ago. So as soon as it comes out, they send me an email mentioning that it came out, and I download it, and I thumb through it.
Yes, I've received my electronic version, and that's a problem to me. With my Linux system, navigating their website in order to flip between the pages of the electronic version to me is very, very troublesome. So part of it is my lack of skill. Part of it is my particular system with all the built-in protections that my son has added. Makes it very difficult to navigate that thing. So I would much rather flip pages. You got it, Roy. Thank you.
Well, I agree. And finally, I just kind of read the really interesting articles that way. I wait for the paper edition, and I read the rest of the stuff there. But you might want to double-check it now, because they fiddled with the software from the first year or two, and it's a bit easier to navigate than it has been in the past. I'm not saying it's incredibly easy, but you might find it a little bit easier in the last year.
I thank you, Roy, and go right ahead with your presentation tonight.
Okay, so I guess we'll go into magnets. People like magnets. People like playing with magnets. And one of the first non-amateur radio topics that I heard on the TechNet after I was licensed was a discussion on magnets. And it was this particular question that I'll throw out to the audience and see if we can figure out this time. The question that seemed to fascinate people, and I think it was something like 5.5 years ago, was some guy came on and he said, I have this magnet, a bar magnet, and I split it in two. I just snapped it in half. And the thing just kind of wanted to reattach itself. It stuck back together. And then another guy chimed in saying, you know, that's very weird, because I had a bar magnet that I snapped in half, and the damn thing wouldn't go near each other. I couldn't even put the damn thing together. So the ultimate question of that night was, why is it that when you snap a magnet apart in two, sometimes it wants to reform, and sometimes it wants nothing to do with the other half?
Does that mean when it does nothing to do with it, doesn't want to have anything to do with it, that you ended up with two ends that are broken, both of them were North Pole, or both of them were South Pole, and therefore you were getting magnetic repulsion? Is that what you thought he was sensing, Roy, go ahead?
Yeah. In one case, there's repulsion, in the other, there's attraction of the two broken halves. Yes, George.
I learned about it very early, taking apart large speakers, audio speakers, and I would find if we cracked them, to crack the magnets that were actually in there in these speakers, I would have a lot of the same experiences. And I always felt it was, or my belief was, density, amount of electromagnetic composition in the density of the metals. The density, number one, the amount of electromagnetic composition, and the surfaces that it was on. I might be all wrong, but I felt there was many factors, KD2FIU.
I've got some questions here for you, George. Let's see. You're taking apart loudspeakers, which have a very strong magnet built into them, a steady-state magnet. When you were taking apart, you were disassembling individual pieces. Were those pieces always attracting each other or sometimes repulsing? Why in the world were you breaking the magnetic structures of those speakers? And when you broke the structures for whatever reason, are you saying sometimes there was the broken portion would attract and sometimes it would repel? So answer some of those questions, George. T2FIU, T2RIW.
I think I was interested in how it worked.
You didn't answer the question. Were you just disassembling the parts, recognizing whether or not they were attracted to each other? Were you intentionally breaking the magnetic structure? And if so, why were you doing that? To understand how it works. Were you breaking it by putting it into a vise and snapping it? Were you hitting it with a hammer? I've heard stories of where people will hit a magnet with a hammer and it buoys it. It does sometimes the very strong shock can cause degaussing. So if you were breaking it, yes, you were breaking it to understand how it works. How were you breaking it? There's a zillion ways you can break it. And were you 50% of the time getting attraction and 50% of the time getting repulsion? There's a lot of things you didn't tell us. Over to you, George.
Well, the 10-year-old boy disassembles the speaker, the very large speaker. The magnet is out. Finds that the body of the speaker, the metallic body of the speaker, now has a certain polarization. Okay, now if I break a magnet, I know the first time I did it, it shattered. The second time I try to break it with a sharp chisel to see what I can get out of it. This is the 11-year-old boy. I can't answer this precisely as you're answering it. KD2FIU.
I'm going to send it back to Roy, who's running this show. You got it, Roy. Please.
Yeah, I think Wesley wants to say something about this. He might remember that episode of the Tech Net.
I do not. But the reverse of the polarity change, they repel each other, or they pull each other, is where the breakage is taking place from the position of the blood wall. So the closer to the blood wall from the south wall, or the closer to that were the North Pole. Interesting.
You talked about the black wall. What does the
black wall? Black wall.
What does the word black wall mean?
Black wall. B L O T H.
Wes, I'm afraid I don't know what a block wall is. I know what a north pole and a south pole is. I'm not quite sure what a block wall is.
Block wall is the place between the north and south where the poles are equal to.
Okay, so are you saying that if you split a magnet directly in half, it has a different quality than if you split it in third and two-thirds or one-quarter and three-quarters? Is that...
One of the ways to explain is that the bar magnet in question has a dipole moment perpendicular to its length. So you broke it. The parallel to the dipole moment resulting repulsion. Then again, if you have spoon in your hand and you would have realized that the magnet was not normal, you see the reason why the broken edge repelled. But I'm kind of surprised that both of you gentlemen cannot recognize that hole. So, would you please name the place between north and south of the magnetized material that has the minimum of oriented domain? Interesting.
Question.
Yeah, George.
What if we were to do this on a boat? Or a ship that was traversing back and forth, north and south of the equator. And I'm not sure if we could bring in which hemisphere. I can't imagine which hemisphere it would be this. But let's say we were looking for some type of equalization or polarization from either pole, but we're on a ship. And we have the ability to traverse either way, north and south of the equator, with our experiment right here.
For the sake of not confusing anyone, this experiment can be done on water, on land, or in the middle of outer space, and it would pretty much play out the same exact way. And Wesley got so close to it, he kind of ran around it, he might have answered it, but there were other things involved. I'll let you know the very strange suggestion that was made at the time about 5-6 years ago. It was that when you snap a magnet in half, you produce a shockwave. And shockwaves, the theory was, can realign magnetic fields, and sometimes the shockwave would realign it in opposing polarity, and sometimes it wouldn't oppose it. And so that's why sometimes it would repel, and sometimes it would attract. So that was apparently one of the theories thrown around. I just throw it out for the sake of muddying the water even more.
Ahmed, are you saying there was a random variable involved in Roy, and then somebody else wants to be picked up? You got it, Roy.
No, there wasn't a random variable. I'm just saying that was a suggestion made from someone who thought that was the solution to the problem, that a shock wave would spontaneously reverse the magnetic polarization of the magnetic domains in one of the magnets. But let's hear from the person who had a question or a comment.
Roger, this is Mike number 2, K1FJM, via Wikipedia, Bloch-Walt, B-L-O-C-H. That's Bloch-Walt is a narrow transition region at the boundary between magnetic domains over which the magnetism changes from its value in one domain to that of the next, named after physicist Felix Bloch. Thank you very much.
Very much, Mike. I learned a new term. And I might share with you another term later on in this talk. But, okay, so Bloch-Walt. But it's still kind of, again, Wesley, you came precariously close to solving the problem. You want to sort of try to expand upon why one split magnet repels and the other split magnet attracts. You sort of said it, but then you went around the block wall.
No, it's not going around the black hole. It's the positioning of the place of breakage towards the black hole. That's what it is. I could explain. I'm not sure if my English is sufficient enough, but I exactly know the answer. Where the broken magnet attracts or repels each other depends on what its pull looks like. If your original magnet looks like north, left, south, and right, and after it's broken, it becomes north, south, north, south. Let me drop. So the two parts will attract each other. However, if the original magnet looks like north on the top and the south at the bottom, not on the side, then after it's broken, it becomes north, south, also up top and bottom and top and bottom. So therefore, two parts will repel each other. And of course, those two cases are only two simple cases. In reality, we may have one single block of metal magnetized in many different ways. So you could have a 3, 4, or 5, or 6 different areas with their independent black holes inside one magnet. And those are sometimes used in the furniture to close the door and then stop and then close it a little bit more. And to adhere.
You are quite right, Wes. There are complex magnets with very complicated domain structures that do all kinds of fascinating things. But for the sake of this particular experiment, I submit to you it's just a very, very simple bar magnet. It's a rectangle. It's wider in length than in width. The top is north, the bottom is south. Anyone else have any suggestions, conclusions, ideas?
That is broken, it becomes north-south, north-south. The top is north, the bottom is south. The top is north, the bottom is south of the second one. Therefore, two parts will reveal each other.
One of the variables involved here, I think, is a property called coercivity, if I've got it correct. In other words,